Thanks for downloading this episode of Cork Talk with me, Tim Atkin. A weekly conversation with some of the most famous people in the world of wine.
This podcast is brought to you in partnership with Nomacork by Vinventions. Driven by a commitment to innovation, the new plant-based Nomacork Green Line offers significant improvements in wine closure performance. Thanks to a rigorous oxygen ingress rate, you can decide which cork is best for your wine, whether it's for young and fresh wines or for those with aging potential.
Born and brought up in New York, where she made wine with her father in the basement of their house as a kid, Natalie Oliveros had a very successful career in the adult entertainment industry as Savannah Sampson before buying a majority stake in La Fiorita in Brunello di Montalcino in 2014. Our fascinating chat covered her love of Sangiovese, celebrity wines, organic viticulture, how climate change is affecting Tuscany, and the power of the word no. Hello, Natalie, and welcome to the podcast.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
It's an enormous pleasure. And I think you're back in New York, aren't you? I saw you in London recently. I know you're a jet setter.
Yes, I'm in Manhattan. I'm in my apartment in Manhattan.
Yeah. Lucky you. I mean, you were kind of brought up in New York, weren't you? Classic immigrant family in many ways. I mean, quite mixed, really. You know, it's Irish, German, Scottish, Italian, I think, the ancestors.
That's right. My dad is Scottish, you say Scottish or Scottish, Italian, and my mom, German, Irish. But I really grew up Italian. You know, my Nona, we called her Nona, from Calabria. Well, she was born in the States, but my roots are from Calabria. And, you know, having the Nona's noodles, and she would make the homemade pasta and Nona's sauce, and we would always ask her, like, what's the secret of the sauce? And even call her and say, is it a magic pot or is it this or that? So my Nona was just so wonderful.
Did she live nearby or not?
Yeah, so originally I was in Governor, New York, and my Nona was there. In fact, I was born in Rochester, but my dad missed his mom, and so we moved back to Governor, which is way northern New York.
And you were one of, what, five? Five sisters?
I have four sisters, so I'm one of five girls.
And were you number one, the eldest?
I'm the second oldest. Yeah. So there's Nicole, Natalie, Noelle, Nadine, and Natasha. My mom would yell us, go, neek, nack, nope, whoever you are. And we would laugh. And so,
did you get confused with all the N's?
Well, exactly, yes. And we were all supposed to be James Adam because there was no one to pass on the family name. You know, my dad's dad died on the SS Swordfish in World War II. Yeah. And so my whole life I kind of felt guilty for being a girl, you know. And I said, well, I'll just keep my name. But then I realized really what's in a name, it's the blood you're passing on.
Yeah. And what this interest in wine started quite early because you made a bit of wine in the basement, didn't you, with your dad kid?
Yes. It was such a wonderful time. I mean, I remember when the crates of grapes arrived, and we lived in this Victorian house in Governor and in the basement. So there were these two tonneaux. Now I know that they're tonneaux with a stainless steel cylinder inside. And my sisters and I would take turns churning the grapes and, you know, sorting the grapes. My dad, my Nona, my dad's aunts and uncles. And my dad was so happy at that time. And I mean, I was really young. I remember that in one of the grape bunches was this shriveled up thing. And I'm like, oh, that looks like a raisin. And I was so curious. And
you
I took it out, did you? And I ate it. And it was like, it was a raisin. I mean, at that time, a raisin is a dried up grape. But I guess I didn't.
What were the varieties? Were they local, like New York? Were they vinifera or not? Or were they?
They were like Muscadet, yeah. Moscato, something like this. It was like moonshine.
It's a weird Italian. And the Italians drank their own wine, right?
Oh yes, and I remember. So my dad, he would say, you know, who's drinking the wine? He had this wine in the basement. I don't know. We had a pool table down there in the basement, and I knew the neighborhood boys were gone in there drinking it. And then I went to a Catholic school, and I got called to the principal's office, scary Sister Gregory, and there was my dad. And he said, Natalie, I need you to tell me the truth. Who's drinking the wine? I was like, it's the neighborhood boys. And
so it wasn't
I've been getting in trouble with wine for a long time.
Listen, and your other great passion as a kid was ballet. And I think you dreamed of being a ballet dancer, didn't you, at one point?
Oh, yes. I mean, I started in a good school with Jean Spear Ballet when I was 13. And I really didn't have natural, you know, feet or turnout, but I was a good performer, and I was such a passion. I loved it. And I studied Cecchetti method of classical ballet. And I went on to get my advanced as a dancer. But I should have known, you know, when one of the it was from England, the Chichester, England, the Imperial Society of London, England, was, you know, where the Cecchetti method is, you know, where the exams are and whatnot. And one of the examiners said, well, can you sing? And I should have realized that, you know, maybe.
The ballet career was over. It's not going to happen. Yes.
I'm so, but I know I loved it.
Yeah. And how did you become a lap dancer instead? I mean, is that just chance?
Oh, well, actually, when I first moved to Manhattan, I went to study with Diana Beyer. And she told me, she was a guest artist when we would do Nutcracker and whatnot in Watertown, New York. And then I went to Manhattan and took her class. And she told me that I should be in New York, just get a job, get an apartment like anyone else. So I did. I moved to Manhattan. I was quite young. I think barely 18. And I moved in with one of the dancers. So one of my roommates was in Harlem. And she brought me to this strip club that it was like Jimmy's or Bobby's or something. And she told me I'd be really good at it. And she had no breast, but she had a great killer body and she was really strong. And her signature thing was she wore this hat that, you know, like this, just a different hat every time. And could she dance? And she kind of planted the seed that, look, it's a great way to make money and you can live your life. So.
So you just started doing it. Yeah.
Yeah. I worked at Foxwood Casino, and then I knew a dancer. She said, I tip out in one night what you're running around, you know, carrying that tray saying beverages, you know, what you make the whole night. And so I went to Manhattan. I auditioned for scores and I got the job then.
And how did you move from that into adult entertainment, the movie world as well?
So I really have to blame Howard Stern. It's his fault. So, I mean, you know, Howard would come in and they chose me to, you know, I would do so many things on the Howard Stern show. I mean, they always found a way to put me in the game. In fact, the first time it was when Private Parts was coming out, his movie. And so the first time I went on the show, they wanted someone to come out and get people to go on the party bus to look at clips from the movie. So I show up in my fur coat and my black lingerie with the heels and the stockings. And I didn't think I was going to actually be on the show. But they said, no, you have to come meet Howard. And so I went in, I dropped my coat. And then from then on, it was history. And he told me, he's like, yeah, you're going to do adult film one day, you know? So.
And any funny stories like to tell us? I mean, you know, it always seems quite serious, these things on the set, but you must have a laugh. I mean, there must be moments when you just burst out laughing at things, are there or not? I don't know.
On the actual Vivid set?
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, yeah. I mean, I can think of more traumatic scenes, you know, than, I mean, it's funny when you think about it, like, oh my gosh, like one time, you know, it's hard for a guy to, you know, keep the wood, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And it's frustrating. It's like, why aren't I enough? And so, you know, waiting around, you know, they don't really have fluffers, you know? So he says, go get the girl. There's a girl in the red car. Go get her. And so it's like, okay. So they go out and get this girl with bare feet, dirty feet, you know? And so she sat there with her feet up, her dirty feet, and finally he was able to continue with the scene. So there was a lot of crazy stuff.
So what the dirty feet turned him on?
Yeah, that turned him on. Not me, the dirty feet.
takes all sorts, doesn't it, really? I mean, you're rightly proud of your achievements on screen. I think you won 11 AVA, so Adult Video Awards, and the kind of the Oscars of your industry. Yeah? You're a big star. I mean, just do you think we're too prudish, a bit hypocritical about sex sometimes? I mean, you know, we all do it. We all, well, most of us, we all enjoy it. Do you think sometimes we've said, oh, that's a bit kind of...
Well, you know, it's like porn can be annoying for people, but yet... You know, when the moment is there, you do it, and then maybe feel a little guilty about it afterwards, you know. But I don't know. I just think for me, it's another kind of art form. And I think a lot of people, you know, forget that that's, you know, it's a form of entertainment, and it's, you know, serves a purpose and it gives pleasure, you know, just like, you know, other passions like wine, you know. So
No, and I always think that, you know, people get very upset about sometimes about you know, sex in films, and yet they don't get upset about violence in quite the same way. And violence is basically people being unpleasant to each other, whereas sex is most of the time people being nice to each other, right?
Yeah. Well, I think it's like an idea in people's head. And I think that I have been very much a curiosity, and people might, you know, say something behind my back, and then they meet me, and it's hard to, you know, what the preconceived notions are and what the real person is.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think I've been a little bit of an advocate of softening people's thoughts about what it is, what a porn star is.
Yeah.
And the reality of it.
I mean, Stormy Daniels is in the news a lot at the moment for obvious Trump related reasons. And I read, and this may be apocryphal, that her screen moniker was the combination of her first pet's name and the street where she grew up. And if I did that, I would be a very unsexy Bambi Burton. Whereas Clark, cool, who you know very well, Oz Clark is always very funny, but he said he would be Chunky O'Leary, which sounds like an Irish porn star, don't you? It sounds great. Where did your name come from? Because you were Savannah Sampson. How did you come up with that? Was it your pet's name and the street you lived in?
No. If it was my pet's name and the street I lived on, my name would be Frisky Clinton.
That's pretty good.
Which is a little too political. Like, that's what Brooklyn should have been called, Frisky Clinton. So when I first started dancing at Scores, they had a Natalie. I would have been Natalie. I didn't care. Well, Natalia, I guess. So I had to pick another name. And I really loved the name Savannah from, you know, the movie The Prince of Tides?
Yeah.
With Nick Nolte?
Yep.
Well, the sister of Nick Nolte in that movie was Savannah, and I loved that name. And then when I was going to make a movie, I realized there was a Savannah who committed suicide, so I had to have a last name. And I wanted, you know, the same initial SS. And so I picked Samson. It's, you know, for strength, you know, Samson and Delilah, kind of biblical by name.
I like that.
Samson.
Yeah, it's got a certain ring to it, isn't it? It worked.
Yeah.
Right. Before we leave that world, because I do want to talk about wine, you'll be pleased to hear, I just wonder if there are any similarities between those two worlds, between, you know, porn, adult entertainment and the wine world. Do you ever find yourself in the wine world thinking, God, this so reminds me of the stuff I used to do?
Well, it's just, they're both two very passionate worlds. And in that, and they both give pleasure and tantalize the senses, if you will. And I think of it sometimes, I mean, a little less so, you know, the descriptions you can use these days with wines, like, you know, feminine, masculine isn't something that is kosher these days, you know, with the legs. And I always describe wine as sexy and, you know, full bodied, voluptuous, and all those things that I'm like, this is just like describing a woman or describing a porn scene. So,
and what do you think about these people saying, you know, masculine wines and feminine wines? Do you think that has a bit of resonance still?
I think it, I mean, it makes sense to me. You know, I don't know. It's, it makes sense. And there is a bigger, bolder wine to me seems like you should be able to say it's a masculine wine, whereas it's something more delicate, a little bit more elegant, is, you know, a feminine, you know, what people think of as feminine qualities that, that are very much in wine and also in describing people.
And tell us how you got into wine, because you've talked about, you know, being a kid making wine with your dad. You know, were you drinking wine while you were in the movie business, or were you starting to get interested?
No, so my experience with wine, I mean, so I was, you know, dancing, lap dancing, as you call it so beautifully. I decided to make my first wine. I was already in my entertainment. I was already with Vivid, and I was looking for something to put me in the mainstream light. But besides that, I mean, I traveled to Italy and France, and I fell in love with the whole thing. But it was very intimidating. And I thought, you know, people just like smell it, say, oh, it's currants and this and that. And I'm picturing my grandfather's old boots or an ice cream cone or, you know, birds flying away, but I was always intimidated to say, and I said, one day I'm going to have my own winery and you'll be free to describe it any way you like. First thing that comes to mind is close your eyes and say it. But my first wine, I, I was looking, I said, what can I do? I know I'm not going to be in front of the camera forever. You know, what can I do that is something that my family can be proud of and that I can bank on in the future? And I thought, what better way than my love for wines? But I really was just experiencing Italy and France, wine regions, and nothing in America.
And you married into wine a bit, didn't you? I mean, I think your ex-husband, I hope we're allowed to mention him, was a wine merchant, mm-hmm. running Royal Wine Merchants in Manhattan. Did you move in wine circles with him, or were you too busy focused on your own career?
Oh, no. He really taught me so much about wine. And I had so many experiences with him. I mean, you know, I got to sit in front of Bartolo Muscarella for hours, you know, he's making his little... his labels with the beetles or the ladybugs and the barriques flying away. And we would sit there for hours. And Gianfranco Soldera, I mean, just so many experiences, you know, traveling with him throughout Italy and France. And,
it was Italian stuff, like, was it?
It was Italian, also like Jean Michaud and Hermitage, and going to the Vaugirard was, I think, my first winery I ever visited. So I had a lot of wonderful experiences. And even to this day, you know, all sorts of, you know, wine producers, you know, come to New York and we end up having a dinner together, you know, with wine producers, you know, Luca Corrada from Vietti and Elena and, you know, all sorts
I mean, these are pretty elite producers, as you said. It's a big step up from your dad's Moscato in the basement, isn't it?
You know, what's so sweet. My dad came to visit. And my family came to visit one summer in Italy. I think we were bottling the 09 vintage. And, you know, it's a big, you know, you're taking the bottles, putting them on the, it's, you know, almost backbreaking. And my dad was like, wow, Natalie, this is quite a different setup you got here going on than we had in our basement. And I saw the same kind of joy, him putting those bottles to get, you know, to have the cork put in. And I saw his face. The same kind of pride that he had when we were in the basement. So for that, it was all worth it.
Is he still alive?
Yes.
Yeah. So he's proud of the wines. He gets to drink them, I hope, does he?
Oh, yes. Of course, I send them, bring them every time. Yeah, he's proud about the wine.
You had this big break, in a sense, where you met Roberto Cipresso, who you ended up buying La Fiorita from. How did you meet Roberto? Were you in Montalcino? Were you in Tuscany? Tell us about how you met him.
The first time I met Roberto was the first time I came to Montalcino. It was springtime and everything was in bloom. And I couldn't believe the aromas in the air. Like, I opened the window and I guess it's the Ginestra. Now I know it's the Ginestra, that yellow weed that grows everywhere. That's just so amazing. And the ingredients. And La Fiorita was the first winery that I visited.
Wow.
Roberto had his, he's like this little cellar in Castelnuovo dell'Abate. And so I met Roberto then, and he was a friend of my ex-husband. So, you know, I was at their wedding, you know, him and Marina's wedding, and we were at the Schaff Winery with Jean-Louis Schaff, and he came out of the cellar with this old, dirty bottle, and he held it like I would hold my baby. And I was said, you know, because I had said, you know, one day I'm going to have my own winery, but I was thinking, well, why wait? Like, if one of the winemakers that I've come to know would agree to make a wine for me, I knew it would be great. So I asked Roberto if he'd be willing to make a wine for me, and he said he would be honored to do so as long as I'm there and I'm not just sticking my name on it.
Yeah.
They're tasting blending, and I wouldn't want it any other way.
And that was Sonia Uno, was it?
That was Sonia
First Dream.
Uno. Yeah? First Dream, yes.
And when was that? What year?
So it was an 04 vintage, and so I guess I released 05, closer to 2006.
And was it a Sangiovese?
So it was 70% Chesanese, 20%... Sangiovese and 10% Montepulciano.
Okay, yeah, fun.
And yeah, I loved it. It was like, you know, because I could have picked something easier to sell,
yeah.
You know, something, I don't know, people in America know about Merlot or whatever, but I loved the idea that it was, you know, a grape that had been forgotten about, or, you know, winemakers in the past tested its strength instead of its delicate side. And it was spicy, and yet there was a sweetness, you know, chocolate undertone. So I thought it represented very much who I was at that time.
And one of the many things I like about you is, you know, you've never used your fame to market the wines. You know, you've not done a celebrity wine. I mean, lots of people do celebrity wines. Why did you not want to do that? Did you just think it was a bit naff, or what was it that turned you off doing that?
Well, my Sonia line was, you know, I thought, how, you know, what can I do? A way to carry on a legacy of Savannah Sampson, which once I bought La Fiorita, it just was so silly. It's like, it's not a novelty. The wine will speak for itself. Here's something real, something beautiful that is timeless, that could be forever. And, you know, when you put a persona behind a wine, then it might become somewhat of a novelty. And it's not a secret, obviously. Like, I've never hidden anything that I've done. And in fact, you know, anytime anyone, you know, a story, then that's probably the fun part about the story. But the wine itself is something so special in itself. And in essence, it brought me back to my roots, this whole wine venture.
Yeah. It's your Italian roots, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And the Savannah name and my idea of that seemed so important at the time is not so important.
And Savannah felt like a persona you'd outgrown, in a sense. You'd left behind, did it?
I love her.
I do.
And, you know, it's like so many, two ends of the spectrum, but I'm somewhere there in the middle, and, you know, I'll never denounce her.
I like that.
Because I think she's pretty cool.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah. And you bought a stake in La Fiorita, which was Roberto's winery, wasn't it, in 2011? And you've said you'd always wanted to own a winery. I mean, you probably know that saying that the fastest way to turn a large fortune into a small one is to invest in a wine business. Well, what made you invest in Montalcino? Was it just because you knew Roberto and it was there? Did you look at other regions?
I would have, but I think that Montalcino chose me. And I know it sounds crazy, but I mean, the first time I was there, I had such an overwhelming feeling of like deja vu or belonging, yeah, or something really powerful. But I had said, so I had my little journey through Italy, you know, with my Sonia line, Campania, Sonia Due, Sonia Tre was in Piemonte.
So and you made wines from different regions, didn't you? Like there was a Campania one, wasn't
yes,
there?
Yes, a Falanghina, yeah, Sonia Due, yeah, and Barbera, one of the few feminine grapes. I love that, Barbera. But I didn't own anything. So I said, and I met Louis Camilleri, and he asked me, well, what are you doing? You know, you don't own it. It's true. I didn't own anything. I would just buy grapes or, you know, buy the juice or do the blend. And I said, well, it's time to find the Sonia Vera, the true dream, something that I can call a home and buy it. So I was going to look, but it was like the universe called out and Roberto called me the same moment and said his partners want to sell La Fiorita, would I be willing to buy them out? So it was one of those things that just be careful what you put out in the universe because it might just happen. Yeah. And it did.
And it's like Montalcino was waiting for you, in a sense.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so I found my investor who, you know, I already knew who that would be. And we went to Montalcino and literally became the proud owners of La Fiorita.
and yeah, you're the majority shareholder since 2014, aren't you?
Yes. So
yes.
And
did you kind of fall in love with Sangiovese at the same time as you fell in love with Brunello di Montalcino? And Brunello is obviously a synonym. It's, people often say it's a sort of clone, isn't it, of Sangiovese. Did you fall in love with,
yes,
both at the same time?
It's the blood and heart of Montalcino. This grape, yeah, I really think why, besides it's just, you know, amazing, makes amazing wines, but yes, this grape is like a chameleon, and there are so many different soil types and microclimates of Montalcino and how it can adapt and change with each grape. And I kind of love that. And, you know, in that I feel like there's a part of me that can adjust to any situation, you know. And I think that's why I was successful in my scores days, and that I could talk about whatever, I could be whoever you want me to be. And I feel like this grape is so incredible at what it can, how all these different soils, and we have vineyards all around it, so we have a little best of all these areas, and what this grape can do, and the way we we age it and, you know, we treat it separately in each different spot. And when you do a tasting in the cellar, you can really taste that different.
I used to write a lot about Brunello di Montalcino, and so it's a reason I know reasonably well. It's a very large region, but there aren't many vineyards, aren't there? It's only about 2,100 hectares. But the subregions vary a lot, and you it's interesting that you've got vineyards in different bits of the region. Just for people who've never been there, and I wish they had been there, because as you said, it's easy to fall in love with, isn't it? It's beautiful. Just tell us a little bit where it is. You know, you're in Tuscany, obviously, and about the major influences on it, can you?
Okay, so we have vineyards. So we have a really special vineyard on the southeast of high altitude, averaging about 360 meters, and there the soils are, you know, there's galastro, so very stony soil, the water draining and the vines digging deeper and deeper to find the water and get all that minerality and clay and slate, and it's all within one vineyard. It's pretty fascinating. And then La Fiorita, where the cantina is, there's another hectare of vineyard there. And then on the south, Colosorbo, we have red and white soil, so a lot of clay in the soil. And then that adds a bit of a spiciness to the wine, and that's about 180 meters above sea level. And then on the southwest, very sandy soil. So in 2014, we planted baby Sangiovese, moved olive groves very carefully, replanted the olives, and planted in 2014 there. And you have to see what came out of the soil, you know, these big fossils, which we strategically placed in the walls around La Fiorita. But amazing, so very sandy soil. And then a couple of years ago, I bought another 2 hectares on the southwest of high altitude.
And the southwest is tends to be the warmest sub-area, doesn't it, more or less? I mean, because you're closer to the ocean, really.
Well, I mean, like you said, it's not that much of it. It's not that far. They're not that far away from each other. But I think the vineyard on the south is, we usually harvest that one first. Yeah. So it can be like that's 2 weeks between harvests at least.
And you've got four vineyards and you blend the four, do you, or not?
Right. So we harvest separately, age separately, and then at the end determine the blend for the Brunello di Montalcino, or we do have a crew, if you will. Our reserva is single vineyard, so from whichever vineyard provides the best fruit for ageability.
And that changes. Yeah,
it does, but it generally comes from Piombo Salino, the vineyard on the southeast. There it's partially protected by forest. There's a valley below that creates a cool current, so warm days, cool nights, really slow maturation. So generally, there is where the single vineyard is.
As we said, you were pretty much in charge from 2012, but you had the majority shareholding in 2014. What was your vision from the start? What did you want to change? I mean, tell us about that.
Well, I remember, you know, even saying to when Roberto had still was winemaking, the winemaker, I was like, can we get some big barrels? Like, I want to make it a little, I was finding a little oaky.
He was using small French barrels or something.
Yeah, he was using tonneau. Yeah. So first use, second use, third use. And I guess he didn't like that too much. But so then we started using, he got the large botti. And because I don't want to change the
botti are these enormous barrels, like traditional barrels, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And wow, we have a variety in the new cantina. It's really incredible. So we'll place, we'll... The wine from the clay, maybe we'll go on the Slavonian oak. And then we have French and German barrels made in really high altitude, Alto Alige, so really fine grains for really slow influence. And we'll put the best of the best from Piombo Salino in there. And then at the end, we have Gamba, you know, with French oak, but Italian made. So these different barrels, and then, you know, move them as it influences the wine, and then at the end decide the blend.
And you also started, I mean, you've been certified organic, I think, since 2019. Was that part of the vision from the start when you took over? You thought, hey, okay, I want to go organic?
Oh, yes. Yes, to be organic seemed important. So we've been managing organically since I came on board, but the certification takes time. And of course, the baby vineyard of Giardinello could be organic from the beginning, but the others had to make the transformation.
Okay, yeah. And it's interesting, I mean, it's that bit of Tuscany is dry. It's one of the warmest and sunniest bits of Tuscany. But I think you were saying this year, 2023, or rather last year, it was quite a difficult vintage for you, wasn't it, being organic, that you'd had problems with Peronospora, with rot and all sorts of things, really?
Yes, it's a challenge. I'm really happy to be organic, but when you have issues come up like in 2023, so the Peronospora, and it rained a lot, so the treatment we were doing organically would just wash off, so it really affected very quickly a lot of the vineyards, but we're learning from it. So, and like, how do we control this, the heat and the changes in the climate?
Well, I was going to ask you that. How do you? Because 2023 is unusual to be that wet, isn't it? I mean, how much is it affecting you? Do you think that will Brunello di Montalcino have to allow people to plant at higher altitudes? Because I think there's a limit on how high they can plant, isn't there?
Yes, I think they already did raise it a little bit, but yes. And in fact, La Frita is higher the south, southwest, southeast. I just need a little something on the north, to make it complete.
Well, the north is cold, isn't it? Once you get up towards the woods.
Cooler,
up there.
Yes. Yeah. And I don't remember the exact limit, but I think they did raise it a bit. But we do a lot of things. So to control the alcohol. So we'll try to, harvest up to the fourth post early to use it as a blending tool. We go spend endless time in the vineyard. So cutting away the canopy enough for the wind to get through, but still keeping the canopy of the leaves to protect from the sun. This year we're experimenting with some nets. So it's not... Yeah. Maybe
what to reflect sunlight, basically, yeah?
No, well, to protect from the hail. Yeah, and also the sun will get in, but to protect a little from the sun. Mm. It's an experiment, but so last year with the Peronospora, and then the hail hit our prize vineyard, and, just be in the wrong place at the wrong moment.
One bad vintage, right?
Yeah. And so not only, so then you have the grapes that got split, and then, treating that organically to, help with the bugs are going to eat it if you don't. But also that hit the canopy. So without the photosynthesis, the grapes couldn't mature all the way. So it's a challenge, but keep going.
Yeah. I mean, you've also been working with the amazing Maurizio Castelli, haven't you? He's been your consultant. Just tell us what Maurizio has brought to the wines. He's a very different personality from Umberto Cipresso, I think, for a start, isn't he? But also he makes very different styles of wines, I think.
Yes. Maurizio Castelli is amazing. He's like a big bear, and he's like the king of Sangiovese. And I love that because, we have all these different soils, and he's really, so much care from the vineyard to the glass. And he was a strong influence on how we were going to build our cellar and what the best tools for that. But I also have an in-house enologist, a young man who's really quite talented, Vincenzo Peroni. And, with him and Maurizio, I just see something really just so great that's going into our wines.
Because they've changed a lot, I think, since you took over. They used to be, as you said, quite oaky, that there was a lot of French oak in there. They were dark colored. And I had the pleasure of tasting your wines recently with you in London. And they're very elegant, as well as good value, I think. I mean, I think Flint wines are your importer in the UK on this.
Yes.
Which is great. I mean, you've definitely changed the style.
Oh, yes. So originally with Roberto, it was like 1 year large Slavonian, and then the next second year in the Tonneau, first use, second use, third use. And then going forward, just using Tonneau for the 2 years of aging. And yes, I wanted to make the wines a little bit more elegant. And I thought of as more traditional, visiting Juan Franco Sodera cellar, I wanted barrels like that, and that's exactly what we're doing, and really paying close attention because we're so terroir driven, and to really get the most extraction that from the earth to the glass.
Could we sort of say modernized tradition? That'd be a fair comment. Not you, the wine.
yes, but excuse my ignorance, but like, I remember back in, 1999, not being able to imagine even saying Brunello di Montalcino, you know. So
my mind.
Sorry?
And now you own a winery
then. Yes. So my knowledge is always growing. And so what for to say to think of it as modernized when I'm thinking that's more traditional.
Yeah.
But I just want to make wines that the Appellation can be proud of, the consortium can be proud of, and that are just amazing for the, for whoever tries them.
Tell us about your top wine, because it's called Fiore di No. Yeah?
Fiore di No.
Yes. And NO, or No, obviously stands for Natalie Oliveros. They're your initials. But there's a kind of wider significance to the No, isn't there? Tell us what the No, what are you saying No yes. to?
Yes. Yes, I say no to yes. So it's really hard to find a new name for wine. So we love the no idea, but then there's a Pinot, so Fiore di No. And people say, why no? I say, well, it's my personal blend. So, and it also happens to be my name. But forget about the name. Who cares about a name? No, it means so much to us. Like no nasty chemicals, as we're certified organic as of 2019. No barrique, no tonneau, no compromise, absolutely no compromise in the winemaking, in the vineyards. But no, I mean, there's power in no. Just
I like
think
that.
It's so simple to say, but it's not. I mean, if only I had the words to say no, I mean, I probably would have, you know, saved myself a lot of, you know, compromising positions. What's that?
What would you like to have said no to?
Oh, I mean, from a very young age, I didn't, I'm a people pleaser, and I didn't know how to say no. That's not good for me at this time. I would make excuses or beat around the bush. It's still hard for me to say no. And it comes with age and confidence, you know, but,
I like that idea very much. There is a power in no, isn't there?
There is power in no. And I think so many people, like even the YouTube, or the Me Too movement, that people, women, me included, you know, don't want to come forward because we didn't use our word. Maybe it's our fault. We didn't say no. And even for those are extreme circumstances, but just simple things. Just say no, that's not good for me. Or no, but I love the also with the Fiore di No, because if when you pour it and the bottle goes upside down, it is on, baby. So we have a lot of fun with it. You know, app, it's like, is it a yes day or no day? Oh, it's always a no day.
That's very good. Another thing you told me about that you're involved in is you're in a theatre group called DH & Co, and you're preparing an off-Broadway show called The Ghost Wife. And I think The Ghost Wife is you, isn't it? And it sounds rather intriguing. Can you tell us about it?
Yes, it's Ghost Wife Radio, actually, and it's John Krasakinas. And it's about a guy whose wife dies quite young, but he has a better relationship with her after she's dead. And we'll start rehearsals in the summer. I'm excited, you know, because I put so much work into DH & Co, Deborah Headwall and Company, but it's really like a gym for actors where, you know, you practice your skills, you know, whether it's listening, moment to moment work, living truthfully in imaginary circumstances. So now to be able to actually put all that work on stage, I'm excited.
Fingers crossed it goes to Broadway afterwards. Yeah.
Yes.
But then you wouldn't have time to go to Italy, right? You'd be too busy acting.
Right. So at first John's like, well, we're thinking about putting it up in October. And I'm like, I don't think that's going to work.
Bad time. Tell us how you get away from wine. I mean, do you like to cook? Is the bit of your nonna cooking with your granny? Is that still part of your life?
Oh, I do. And finally, you know, my nonna passed away now 2 years ago. And so I'm always making nonna sauce, but it never tastes like hers. And then one of the last visits I had with her, she told me, she's like, it's okay. So you use veal, pork, and beef for the sauce. And you have to really caramelize the beef. And the secret is bones. You have to use bones. And really caramelize the meat. And so now it's not like nonna sauce at all. But I still find, you know, she's with me all the time. But I don't make a whole lot of different dishes. But my son, Lucchino, is crazy. He makes
he's an amazing little chef and has quite the palate. So
I love it. And I always think it's sweet in a way that, that the Nonna's secret didn't die with that. Basically, you learned how you it's not as good, your sauce or your son's sauce, but at least you know the secret. Right?
Yes. And it's also really good. But
And when you're off to Italy again, when are you next going to be in Montalcino?
I'm going to go at the end of May. So fantastic. We're bottling May 2nd, which I can't be there for that, which is tomorrow. But then I'll go at the end of May.
Thank you.
And then be back for my rehearsals in the summer.
Good. Well, listen, good luck with the bottling and good luck with the play and see you very soon, I hope. It's been amazing talking to you. Thank you so much. I enjoyed meeting you very much in London, tasting your wines, and it's been great having you on the podcast.
Thank you so much. This was so fun.
What a fascinating story told by a remarkable person. Natalie's wines really are delicious, combining finesse and value for money. Next week on Cork Talk, my guest is the author Andrew Kayard, who'll be talking about his new 3-volume history of Australian wine. Join me then. Thanks for listening to Cork Talk. If you want to read more reports, articles and tasting notes by me, go to my website, timatkin.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, @timatkin, and on Instagram, @timatkinmw. See you next week.